My name is Lisa Horowitz. I'm 50 years old. Today is December 10th, 2014. We are at NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, and I am your sister and you are my brother.
And my name is David Horowitz. I am 46 years old. It is the same date as you said, and we are in NIH in Bethesda, and I am your brother and you are my sister. So today, we're here to talk a little bit about the last 15 years. I mean, in 2001, around Labor Day in 2001, you were diagnosed with CLL and lymphoma. And, you know, that was a dramatic time in your life. It was a dramatic time in everybody's life in 2001. So we'll talk a little bit about the last 13 years in a 40-minute time frame. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, and thank you for coming down and interviewing me and preparing, and I'll just start out by saying I love you.
Yeah, I love you too. So while we're on the subject, so, you know, while I just said what we're going to be talking about, why don't you just paint a little picture for me about, you know, Labor Day 2001 and what happened?
Sure. Well, as you know, we grew up in New Jersey and our whole family lives there, including you, but I moved to Boston. And I had decided to come down. My husband, Phil, was going to England, and I brought my daughter, Erica, who at that time was 6 months old, down to New Jersey for Labor Day weekend. And I had been waiting to hear about a lymph node biopsy report. And so I was at our sister Sherry's house. And the surgeon, I had been playing phone tag with the surgeon's office, and finally I got a hold of him that day. And the surgeon, he was kind of a not my favorite doctor in the world, and he had a very arrogant manner. But he said to me on the phone, a phrase I'll never forget, he just said, "Lisa, I'm so surprised you have cancer." And I was 37 years old at that time with a six-month-old baby, and I literally dropped to the floor under the weight of those words. That you have cancer just literally dropped me to my knees, and Sherry had to pick me up off the floor, and my little six-month-old baby was in the next room, and all I could think about was, I have cancer. I want to see her grow up. I want to raise this child, and you know, I breastfed her for 6 months. I couldn't imagine her not knowing me. And so I didn't know what this meant. I have lymphoma. And when I asked the surgeon, what does that mean? He said, well, you'll have to ask your primary care doctor. He clearly wanted to get off the phone quickly. So that was a phone call to my primary care doctor up in Boston. And he said, all I remember is there's no cure for the type of lymphoma you have, and you have about 5 to 10 years to live.
I mean, I remember when you told us that same weekend, and I was like, I was shocked. I was appalled. I was working, you know, in computers at the time, and so I immediately went to the internet. You know, it was a little bit, it wasn't as sophisticated now as it was back then. I mean, it wasn't as sophisticated back then as it was now, but I wanted to see what is lymphoma, what are the, you know, there's a million different types. I started learning all about it. I remember, you know, going in, and I don't know if it was Google at the time. I think it was like AltaVista or whatever the search engine was, and trying to find out as much as we can about it. But, you know, I was just like so upset over it, and, you know, I didn't know what to do. I felt helpless, and I felt helpless for you and you, you know, your daughter. You know, you said 6 month old. It was a rough time, right?
Right. And we all convened at Sherry's house.
Right.
And mommy's boyfriend brought mommy over, and you came over. And I remember I didn't want to look on the internet because I didn't want to read all the horrible things that could be there. And you were the computer guy, and you even hooked me up with your friend who was a doctor who gave me some more information.
Right, right.
But I went immediately into a death fog from, you know, all I could think of was I'm going to die and I'm not going to live to see this child grow up.
Right. And she was 6 months at the time, right? Erica was six
yes.
months old?
Yes.
I mean, so then, I mean, you know, it happened to be September 2nd, 2001. And sure enough, it must have been a tumultuous time. I mean, I know it was because I was there. But then a week later, September 11th happened, okay? I know I was flying that day to LA from Newark, and it was just a hairy day. Can you explain, you know, just what happened that day and how your illness affected it? And, you know, I know everybody was freaking out because I was on a plane. I was on United Flight 83 from Newark to Los Angeles, not Newark. I thank God it wasn't Newark to San Francisco. So,
right. Well, after I was diagnosed, I went back up to Boston and I went back to work and I told nobody. I mean, I told my family, knew my very close friends, but I didn't tell anybody at work. So I was walking around in this death fog while we were trying to figure out what was the plan for my lymphoma, because I didn't feel sick. I just had this diagnosis that I had cancer. So I remember September 11th, and it was as surreal as the feeling was to be told you have cancer. It was that same surreal feeling of something was going on in New York City and there was a plane that just hit the World Trade Center. And I worked at a hospital up in Boston at that time. And somebody turned on the TV in the conference room. And it was interesting for our family, I think, because, you know, everybody was so just out of sorts because of my cancer diagnosis. And then the attention turned to you. And where's David? Because you worked in New York City. And I'll never forget this. Sherry called and said, where's David? Is his building near the World Trade Center? And I remember calling Daddy and Daddy saying, don't worry about David. He's not even in New York City. He's on a plane to California. Don't worry about David. And then, of course, you know, what happened that day.
Right. Well, that was a tumultuous time for me, so we don't even have to discuss that now. But
right.
So this is going through your mind, you know.
So I was, I mean, here it felt like people were, you know, our country was being hijacked and assaulted by terrorism. And in this odd way, I had this feeling like that was happening to me on the inside, like I had been hijacked by lymphoma, hijacked by cancer on the inside. And it was as if there was a terrorism inside and outside. But the interesting thing was, from that day on, I could walk around crying and nobody questioned me. So I would walk around at work knowing I had this cancer, worried about not being there for this 6-month-old baby, crying. And nobody said, what's wrong? Because everybody was like that. And so in some odd way, September 11th was like this terrorism on the outside and terrorism on the inside for me.
So you work. So tell me about your job at the time when you worked up in Boston, and what were you doing?
Yeah, so I am a clinical psychologist, and I was working at a hospital in Boston. And
what happened when you, after you got diagnosed, how did that change your work habits?
Yeah, so the cancer hospital that I was had my doctor at was across the street from the children's hospital I worked at. And at first, I was on a watch and wait kind of program where they weren't going to treat the cancer. They were just going to watch. Because there was no cure, there was nothing they could do. But when the tumors got big enough, they would try to beat it down with chemotherapy. So I would go across the street, and eventually I needed chemotherapy, and I'd get my infusion. And then because of the kind of person I am, I could not sit home and be in this death fog and just feel like I was going to die. So I had to keep working. And people thought I was crazy. They're like, you're getting your chemo infusion, and then you pop back across the street.
But it was a time before. There was a time frame before you started getting your chemo infusion. There was a couple of years or a year? Or how long?
About half a year.
Half a year. So did this change anything with your relationship with your daughter or your husband or your family or your friends? How did you break it to them? Or how did you, like you said, you were in this fog.
Tell yes. So I was in this death fog, and every time we would go to a friend's, I had friends who had kids the same age. We'd go to a birthday party and they would light the candles on the cake. And I would in my head say, am I going to be at Erica's second birthday? Am I going to be at her fifth birthday? Am I going to be at her 10th birthday? And that would always go through my mind. So it was like this uninvited guest that was always with me, this cancer, just always in the room, even though I wasn't feeling sick. It was just this idea.
So then you found out you had to get treatment.
Yes.
And, you know, the doctor said, you know, tell me about the first treatment you had and you know, how you were feeling during the time. And
So first I went to this lymphoma specialist up in Boston who didn't turn out to be my doctor because he had a terrible bedside manner. And actually, he said some really awful things to me. But he said this one thing that had stuck in my mind that I never forget. And I asked him, like, can I go to work? Can I still run? Can I do, you know, my normal life? And he said, do not let this disease invalid you more than it already has. Now, I didn't even know invalid was a verb that you could use that way. But that's
sure he didn't mean invalidate.
No, he meant don't let it rob you of any more time. Mm-hmm. And that was like a key thing. Like, I have this precious time. And so I wanted just to do everything. I wanted to just absorb everything. I wanted to be a mother in the fullest sense. I wanted to, you know, see people and be with people I loved being with. And
so then
I found a wonderful doctor in Boston.
Okay, so you found this doctor in Boston. He started treating you.
Yes.
The treatment worked in the beginning.
Yes, so it put me into remission.
Put you into remission. You were psyched. I remember when that happened. I remember I was working in the city at the time at a startup, and all of a sudden I got the call. She went to the doctor. You know, every few months you'd go to the doctor, and I'd be like, oh, my God, I wonder what the results are. And then you found out you were in remission. It was like a happy day. I, like, celebrated with, like, big, big fattening lunch and everything. So I remember when that happened, and then, you know, how long is it going to last? So I think it ended up lasting, I don't remember, I think it was like 18 months or 12 to 18 months or something like that. So then you would continuously go back to the doctor every few months and get your scans, and, you know, eventually you got a scan that said, oh, it's growing back. So how did you feel at that time? And what was going on in your life? I mean, I think, you know, there was a time when you were, you know, it's hard because it's such a long period between when it happened, but you moved from, you were moving
Boston
to Washington. So talk about that.
So I had developed this really good relationship with my Boston doctor, and then my husband, Phil, got a job at NIH in Bethesda, and he wanted to move. And I didn't want to move. I mean, I had, my friends were all up there, my family was up there, but my cancer doctor was up there, and I didn't want to leave.
And just before, let me just stop you for a second. There wasn't any, like you said, you had 5 to 10 years. There wasn't any cure at the time. Like, stem cell transplants weren't like they are today.
Right. So there weren't, at that time, and this is how much the science has caught up.
Did you even know what stem cell transplants were?
No, I didn't even know that that was an option for me. And in fact, nobody mentioned that. They just assured me there was no cure. So I remember they called them mini bone marrow transplants, but they were non-myeloablative transplants where they were starting to do them on people with lymphoma like I had. And I remember once Phil and I went to the doctor and my doctor said, I want you to see the transplant doctor up here in Boston. And he said, you know, you have about a 40% chance of a cure. And I remember walking out of there feeling awful, like just sullen and ugh. And Phil looked at me and he said, what's the matter? I'm like, 40%. He goes, you just went from 0 to 40% chance. That's good.
You got to look at it the right way. Grass,
We were moving back to Boston. We were moving down here to Bethesda, so I was leaving my Boston doctor. And I remember when he told me, he said, there's this wonderful doctor at NIH named Dr. Wyndham Wilson. And he felt very strongly about him, that he was going to be a good doctor for me. And, you know, I had this big attachment to my doctor in Boston.
Right.
So I was also looking forward to meeting Dr. Wilson.
And was it aggressive at the time, or were you in remission at the time?
Yeah, so at that time, when we made the decision to move, I was in remission. And 3 weeks before the move, I went for my routine CAT scan. And I remember I was just talking about the move with Phil in the waiting in the exam room.
Right. But at that time, before you get to that, so it was, what year was it, 2007?
2006.
2006. And I know that there was, you know, there were, you know, advances being made, because I know that I had another friend who was diagnosed with leukemia a few years earlier, and we started going to this Gift of Life gala every year. So we donated some money and we went to this gala every year, and they would be stem cell transplants, survivors.
Yes.
And the survivors would come and meet their donors, and they would talk with each other. And I was just, you know, I think the science started to catch up a little bit.
Yes.
So when did you learn that that was, you know, when did you learn about that
and
the transplant
situation? So it was probably a couple years, about a year or two before I moved, when I knew a transplant was on the
possibility
radar screen for me.
Oh, right. Then that was the 40%.
Right. That was the
40%. Oh, okay. Okay. Good. I forgot. Right.
So I was having this, my doctor came in looking very pale and said, it's back. And it was I had just sold my house in Boston. We were moving down to Bethesda.
Right. Great timing.
Yeah.
Thanks, Doc.
Yes. So coming to NIH was, first of all, I when my husband got a job at the National Institute of Mental Health, I also got a job at the National Institute of Mental Health on the psychiatry service, so I was going to see the medical patients. But my first introduction to NIH was coming here as a patient. And I met Dr. Wilson, and I could tell he was very smart, and he knew everything there was to know about lymphoma, and I put my confidence immediately in him. And then the funny thing was, a week later, after I came here as a patient, I had to start my job at NIH. So I felt like a double agent, like I was an undercover cancer patient working in the clinical center as a psychologist who was going to see cancer patients and evaluate them for mental health concerns.
So you're in the middle of you find out you're out of remission. You're moving your entire family from Boston to Washington to a new job, a new house. You don't have any friends. I mean, did you know anybody down here?
I had one friend.
One friend down here. And, I mean, that just must have been such a, like, how did you even handle that?
Yeah. I feel I was held together by threads and you and my family and my friends. And I just kind of soldiered on. Like, there was no other choice. I just had to go through. And I remember
tell me about your first day. I was just going to say, tell me about your
first
day
at
NIH.
Work. So my first day at work, I was working for this wonderful boss at the clinical center, Don Rosenstein. And he was he was clinical director. And he said, "Lisa, I'm going to take you on my first consult with me." We did consults. We saw the medical patients. It's a cancer patient. It's a lymphoma patient. And we're going to...
He didn't know that you had
it. He didn't know I had lymphoma. And he said, "We're going to meet Dr. Wilson, and we're going to see we're going to do a consult on one of Dr. Wilson's patients." And I must have just gone white, you know, and I remember that, like, oh, my God, I'm going to meet Dr. Wilson.
Who you've already met.
Who I already met as a patient, and I'm going to meet him now as a psychologist, as a provider. And, you know, what was he going to, is he going to give my story away? What was he going to do? And I remember... he just shook my hand and he said, "Nice to meet you." And he didn't give anything away.
Cool.
He played it real cool, right? But I had to see one of his lymphoma patients and who was needing a transplant. So it was kind of a difficult time.
So was there different trials going on down there
back
then at NIH?
Yes, and in fact, Dr. Wilson had the great thing about NIH. Well, first of all, did you know the nickname for NIH is House of Hope?
No, I didn't.
And that's what it is. It's full of these wonderful clinical trials that people can participate in. And not only can you help yourself, but you can help other people in the future who are going to need the science to catch up like I did. So Dr. Wilson had a phase one clinical trial, which means it had never been tested on humans before. And I was going to take this. It was an oral drug. And you remember it was, I called it yucky fish oil because it tasted awful. It was the worst thing I've ever tasted. But that was later. That was later after I got here. But the funny part was, to me, was I came to know the nurses and the docs here. And, you know, when anytime anyone sees a patient, they wear a white lab coat. And, one day this was months and months after I've been working here, and because Dr. Wilson was still on the watch and wait, he wasn't treating me yet. But then one day I had to get treated because my tumors were growing. And I went up to the 12th floor, which is the oncology floor here at the clinical center. And all the nurses from the National Cancer Institute were up there. And I had just seen a patient with my white coat on. And then I showed back up at 3 o'clock without my white coat. And I said to them, they said, oh, you know, Dr. Horowitz, nice to see you. And I said, I am your 3 o'clock patient. And that was really hard. And the code was when I wore my white coat, I was working. And when I wasn't wearing my white coat, I wasn't working.
You're like a double agent.
I was a double agent patient. I was an undercover double agent cancer patient. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, actually having to get the transplant and, you know, whether you were going to, I know there was a decision to be made. Are you going to go into the trial at NIH, or were you going to go back to your doctor in Boston, which you were very comfortable with because you had known him very well and he had brought you through the, you know, the last few years of treatment. So let's talk a little bit about how that decision happened.
So I went through this experimental trial with Dr. Wilson, and it worked for a little bit, but unfortunately it didn't work.
So that was a trial. That wasn't a transplant. That was just
a new lymphoma treatment.
Right. At the time, it was new.
Yes, and Dr. Wilson, it was when I became in pain from a tumor pressing on my spinal nerve, when Dr. Wilson, and I'll never forget this because I was down here in the getting an MRI, and Dr. Wilson, I actually saw him running down there to look at my results, and he was going to personally just look at them right away, and he knew, and he told me, he was always very frank with me, and he said, Lisa, it's time for you to have the transplant and talk to the transplant team. So I was very torn. Should I go back to Boston and get my transplant, or should I stay here at NIH and get my transplant and be in a clinical trial? And I remember being very torn about that decision, and I was so grateful to you and Daddy who took the train down from New Jersey to come and have dinner with me at the Old Ebbett Grill
During March Madness, I remember, because we were eating dinner at the grill. I think some of the players who were in town were playing, or some of the teams were there eating, too. I remember coming down and having that conversation with you, trying to weigh the pros and the cons of doing it here versus there.
Right. And you know, I didn't have any support system here. I didn't have my friends. I didn't have my family. I barely
You were here
knew
a couple of years, so you had some friends.
I had a few friends, right. So we decided on NIH because I not only had the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, and not only was it going to help me, and this was just, I put my faith in the transplant team because they turned out to be incredible, and they all saved my life. So it was a good decision. But, you know, not only could I participate in something that was going to help me, but I could also participate in something that could maybe help a patient in the future who was going to need a transplant. And that really meant something to me.
So at the time, you needed to get a donor. I mean, you wanted to have a transplant, but just because you want to have a transplant doesn't mean you can have a transplant.
Right.
I know that the siblings are probably the most likely to be a match, and I know, you know, my sisters and I, we went through getting tested, and all I wanted to be was be a match. That's all I could think about was,
yes.
I was already in the Gift of Life registry, but we got separately tested. We went to our doctor, our local doctor. I remember he took several vials, and then a few weeks later, we found out, or, you know, a few days later, we found out that we weren't matched.
Yes.
And I was upset because I didn't know, you know, I'm like, oh, if that's your best chance, what are the chances that we have? So tell me, when you found out that we weren't matches, what went through your mind? But then also tell me about the Gift of Life and the National Bone Marrow Foundation and how that helped.
So it turns out that only 30% of people who need a transplant have a sibling as their donor. Siblings make the best match because you would have the exact a genetic makeup from mommy and daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you and Sherry went to get tested, I first of all, I just wanted one of you to be a match, but I really wanted it to be you. And that was no offense against Sherry, but I really wanted it to be you. And, you know, I know we look a little like, mm-hmm. so I kind of thought it's going to be him.
I thought it was definitely going to be a match. Seriously.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I look like her. People have come up to me and said, are you Lisa's brother?
Yeah. People used to say, are you Horowitz's sister? You know,
I mean, there's no doubt about that. I definitely thought I was going to be a match. And I was really upset when I couldn't.
Yes.
I mean, I remember that night when I found out, I was like upset.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
So when my doctor told me that neither of you were a match, and it was pretty devastating. All along getting a cancer diagnosis, the first punch to the gut is when you hear the words, you have cancer. And then the second punch to the gut was when I fell out of remission. And I guess the third punch to the gut was your siblings aren't a match for you. And my doctor said to me, I said, what are my chances of finding a match in the bone marrow registry? And he said, well, what's your ethnicity, which I didn't even know was related. And it turned out, and being Eastern European Jewish, he said, 20 years ago, I would have told you have no chance. But because of this one organization, Gift of Life, Bone Marrow Foundation, you have greater than 70% chance of finding a match.
Right. And that had been the organization that I had been going to for their gala for the last 5 years.
Right. You had been supporting them.
So I, you know.
So when I, but then he turned to my husband, Phil, who's Asian American, and he said, if it were you, you would have a very poor chance of finding a match. And he told me, if you're African American, if you're Latino, if you're Asian or mixed race, you have a very poor chance of finding a match. And that haunted me throughout my transplant. I mean, I was lucky because I had a match.
Right. So tell me about that. So you got a match. I remember when you told us you got a match, we were psyched, right? And, you know, you got a match.
It was like you won the lottery.
Right.
They called and told me I had a match. And there's wonderful people in the transplant recruitment center where they try to find your match for you. And she said, Lisa, you have a match. And we were ecstatic. And then 2 weeks later, she called and she said, Lisa, your match declined. So,
I remember that too.
That was so the only thing worse than not having a match in the bone marrow registry is having a match that says no. Because you know there's someone in the world who could save your life and they decline. And I wanted to go over his house and show him a picture of my daughter and say, please, I need to live. But, you know, you don't have any information and you can't force anybody to do it. But I was lucky.
And looking back in hindsight, it might not have been the worst thing, right?
No, it was a gift.
It was a gift.
It was a total gift.
So you can't look at it as a bad thing.
Right.
Because now, yes, at the time it was devastating and terrible, but now here we are.
It turned out to be fortunate because my match that I eventually got was this, it was a 33, all you find out is very anonymized information. So it was a 33-year-old man from Ohio is what I was told.
Right, you used to call him Matty, right? Why
I
did
called
you call
him Matty because that stood for my awesome 33-year-old donor man. So I called him Matt. I had to give him a name because he was nameless.
Anonymous.
Meanwhile, he was saving my life. So
I remember when you got the second match, I remember it happened to be, it was in May and we were at this Gift of Life gala. And your friend Evie, who was a bone marrow recipient, was speaking that night. And we were so ecstatic that you got a match that was a good, you know, well, obviously the second match that you find out and the person is willing to do it, you're so much, that much happier because, you know, the first one you had and then declined and you're like devastated. So it was like a win-win.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, my sister's going to be up there on that stage someday.
Yeah. And Evie had a transplant, you know, a few years before me, and she sailed through it. I wanted that kind of transplant.
Right. So you have your match.
Right.
It's May. You're getting your transplant in August or September.
September.
And tell me about the time leading up to that.
So,
you know, what's going through your mind, your family, your friends,
sure.
your support system?
Sure. So, it was 2008, so I'd been here 2 years. And now I had this total stranger stepping up to save my life, which I there's not one day that goes by that I don't think this total stranger stepped up and saved my life. I mean, how do you even thank someone for a gift like that? You know, so I've always felt compelled to pay it forward.
Mm-hmm.
But leading up to the transplant, I didn't know at that time he was going to save my life. I was just hoping. And I had this, first of all, I had the best family in the world. I had you and Sherry and Mommy and Daddy and Art and Tony and Rachel. And I had, you know, these friends that I had down here that I was starting to get to know through Erica's school.
Were they your neighbors or your friends?
Yeah, I had a great neighbor. I had Beth. She was my neighbor. But these Erica's friends' mothers organized a way that they could bring over dinner so that we didn't have to cook. And I remember Sarah Jane came over with an Arctic char.
And wow, that's a nice dinner.
I barely knew her. I barely knew her. Now she's my one of my dearest friends, and she came over with this Arctic char. And, you know, she didn't know me, but she said, oh, I want you to have this dinner, and she baked
It's funny because I think you told me to go to Legal Seafood once and get the Arctic char. You're going to love it.
Yes, I don't know how she knew. She knew, right. But I had friends like her, and then my friend, of course, my oldest friends, Debbie and Ellie, they would come to visit, and my friend Dina, and people would come and accompany me to bone marrow biopsies. And, of course, Mommy and Art came to take care of Erica. And I was just surrounded by love and a community of love. So
now it's time for the transplant. It's September. Walk me through the day of the transplant and how you're dealing with, you know, everything.
Right. So
how did you like go to the transplant? Did you, you know, tell me about the day of the transplant and what happened?
Well, the doctor said it will be very anticlimactic. They didn't know when exactly they were going to do the transplant, so they harvested Maddie's cells, this donor's cells, and they told me they would freeze him. And then when they needed them, they would take them out and use them. I said, you can freeze stem cells? Is that going to be okay? He's like, my doctor said, yeah, it's like chicken. You just take it out of the freezer, you know, before you need it, and you'll use it. And I thought, okay. Mm-hmm. So he said he's going to bring the stem cells in a bag, and it's going to probably smell like garlic, and it's going to be very anticlimactic for the team, but a very, for you know, a wonderful day for me. So they call it day zero, and they brought this little bag. It looked like guava juice. That's, for some reason, it struck me like that. It was purple. And it infused. And I remember thinking I should play some Barry White music and because you want these cells. You know, they wipe out all your stem cells, and you want these cells to go in and be little pioneers and populate and, you know, kind of just make a new immune system. This new immune system was going to recognize the cancer as an enemy and attack it.
Mm-hmm. So then, you know, you had the transplant. I assume, I remember you getting sick a few times while you were in the hospital.
Yeah.
How long were you in the hospital for, exactly? I mean, I remember coming down and visiting you.
I was in for 3 weeks, and the hardest part of that was not being able to be with Erica.
Right.
You know, she was at the time in second grade. She was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And we would Skype, and I remember I was feeling awful, but I would have these phone calls with her. And I was just, and the nurse would always comment. I would just pull together for the phone call, and I'd be like, hi, honey. And I would give her the goodnight tuck in. And then I'd hang up the phone, and I'd collapse on my bed. But the hardest part was being separated from her. But then it was a year of, you know, isolation and wearing a mask. And again, this phrase, don't let this disease invalid you, came into mind. And so, you know, instead of being this busy working mom now, if I could take a walk, that was a good day. Sometimes if I could make it up the stairs, that was a good day. You kind of have to adjust your expectations.
So the next few months, September, October, November, I know it's a big time in the country's life because, you know, President Obama got elected.
Yes.
And then he got inaugurated. Yes. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that and how that affected
It was very special for me because, you know, his slogan was, yes, we can. And I felt like that was my slogan. Like, we can do this. I can get through this transplant. And so when he was elected, and this miracle felt like it happened in the country, and I just was energized, and it was an inspiration to me. Like, yes, we can became my motto, too.
And I know you couldn't go out. Like, you couldn't leave your house, right? I mean, you had to stay
in
your
home. Yes, I had to stay at home.
You know, you had to wear the mask. You couldn't, you know, visitors were, you were germaphobe, basically, for at least 6 months. I think it was a year.
Purell was, you know, buy stock in Purell.
But right. I remember Inauguration Day was a special day in your house. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we all had our Obama OH shirts on. I bought, you know, I could shop on the internet, so I bought Obama shirts for everybody. Phil took Erica down to the inauguration to watch. I took pictures of the TV because I couldn't go.
But how did you, you couldn't join them, obviously, but over the next few months, you started to be able to do things. So tell me about how you acclimated yourself. What was it, 6 months afterwards, a year afterwards?
Yeah, I was missing things.
You were missing things.
I was missing things. And one of the things I was, you know, it's funny when Obama started, he, so he sent his kids to the same school that Erica goes to. And I was always the coach of the basketball team, the recreation little kid basketball team. And his daughter was on the basketball team. And so I mean, I was missing a lot of things during my transplant, but I was also, you know, all of a sudden Phil would come home. Phil was taking over the coaching for me, and he was coaching with President Obama. You know, the next year I would join back in, and then I was coaching with President Obama. But that's another story for another day.
So that's very cool.
That was one of those good surreal things.
Yes, where, a lot of things, good and bad, happened during that time. But you went through your 1 year anniversary. So 9/9/09. I remember you got me a shirt. It says 9/9/9.
Yes, I did.
Okay, tell me about your 1 year anniversary and how did you celebrate and how did you feel?
Okay, so I felt like this new lease on life. I had this pay it forward feeling. We started up this Swabbajeek Save a Life organization so we could increase racial and ethnic diversity in the bone marrow registry. But I remember my friend gave me this card that said, it was a quote from Abraham Lincoln. It said, "It's not the years in your life that count, it's the life in your years." And I am just so appreciative. I mean, I have to tell you, you know, I have my transplant here. So every day I come to work, and I never forget that I am lucky to be able to walk out of here every day, healthy person. You know, the NIH clinical team, my medical team saved my life. And I am so grateful to my family, my friends, my medical team. I'm truly blessed.
And your donor.
And my donor, yes.
And your anonymous donor.
My anonymous donor.
You did eventually find out who it was, but you never really met him.
I never met him, but I've been able to thank him. His name is Joshua. His name is not Maddie. And because this is the power of one, because of what he did, he did this altruistic gesture. He saved my life, and now I can go on to help other people.
Right. And now your Swabbajeek Save a Life has actually given multiple transplants.
Yeah, so we have facilitated 7 transplants. So because this one person stepped up and changed my life, I could go on to help 7 other people.
And hopefully they can go on to help 7 others of themselves, and you'll see how the numbers exponentially grow. So what do you think your biggest takeaway is? I mean, you know, what a 13, you know, I know from a brother's standpoint, it was a roller coaster. I mean, it could only have been a roller coaster for you as well, but I mean, ups and downs and, you know, hairpin turns. One night mommy's like, oh, she's vomiting. She's got to rush her to the hospital. The next night, you know, she's in remission. She got a clean PET scan. I mean, just so many highs and lows. Tell me about your biggest takeaway and your outlook for the future and, you know, your look on life. What is your look on life?
My look on life is appreciate every day. I mean, I know that sounds trite, but really, you know, even though you might be a cancer patient, it might not be the life you recognize, it's still your life. Do something every day and just, you know, everyone has only the promise of now. We're all here for now. So I am forever grateful, forever appreciative to my donor, my family, my friends, the NIH medical team, science, God. I'm truly blessed.
And how does it affect your day-to-day with your daughter? Like when you see an event now, when you get to go to her bar mitzvah, when you got to go to her, you know, I mean, think about it. Your bar mitzvah, you thought that wasn't even an option.
Right. So 12 years ago, I was told I had 5 years to live. And I got to attend Erica's 13th birthday, her bat mitzvah, in April. So I'm glad that I listened to that doctor and didn't let this disease invalid me. I didn't let it rob me. Like, you know,
I'm glad you did too.
Yes. To put years, there's that Abraham Lincoln saying, it's not the years in your life that count, it's the life in your years. And that's really true. And so I think being grateful, I think I will be forever grateful and wanting to share that and help anybody else who's going through a transplant as well.
And now you come to work every day and you deal with these people that are getting transplants. Do you like say I went through it or, you know, does it?
So I never say I had it my own transplant. Right. And, but I think when I listen to them and when I'm listening and when I'm nodding and hearing their story, because their story is different than my story. I think I convey a knowing that I could never do in words by telling them I had a transplant, but I think by listening, and when I say, yeah, that sounds really hard to go through what you're going through, I know what that's like. And I think I'm able to convey that. And the fact, I'm grateful that I could work here at NIH because I feel like I could give back like that every day.
And, you know, to be honest with you, I feel similar. I mean, when I hear somebody getting diagnosed with something, I'm like, you know, it's just a guess. It's not necessarily exactly, you know, if somebody says you have 5 years, it doesn't mean that there's no light at the end of the tunnel. You never know. You can't predict the future.
Right.
So live every day.
The present is very important.
Yes.
And exactly. I'm glad you're here with me.
I'm glad I'm here too. I love it.
And
I'm having
I love
a good time.
Okay.
All right. Good. Thanks.
Thank you.